This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina was not alone in its policy of sterilizing people in its population deemed as feeble-minded or as socially or mentally unfit in some way. It did so for 45 years, from about 1929 through 1974. But North Carolina is alone in offering compensation to the victims of this disgraceful practice. The state has been debating the compensation issue for years, but during this last legislative session, a decision was made on a bipartisan basis to provide $10 million in reparations to the 7,600 people who were victims of this state-sponsored practice. Joining us this hour to talk about how, in an incredibly partisan political atmosphere, the legislature was able to come to a bipartisan agreement on this issue is the Republican Speaker of the House, Tom Tillis from Mecklenburg County. He sponsored the bill and joins us by phone. Welcome back to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
Also with us by phone from Forsyth County is former Democratic Representative Larry Womble. He was the first to really start pushing this issue 10 years ago in the legislature. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. It's my honor and pleasure.
And in our studio is WFAE's Julie Rose, who has been reporting on this story now for, it seems like, years. How long have you been doing this?
About 3 years.
Wow. And Elaine Riddick is also with us. She is a victim of this terrible practice of forced sterilization and joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thank you for being here too, Elaine.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the bipartisan nature of this decision. Mr. Speaker, how did this come about in the atmosphere that we're currently in?
Well, you know, I think first, Mike, it's important to point out there's a lot of bipartisan things that go on in Raleigh, even when we have stark differences on some policy matters. So I think you only hear that the partisan piece. This is one example of it. I mean, Representative Womble introduced me to this many, many years ago when I was a freshman in the legislature, and it's something that's resonated with me ever since. It's taken us time to educate people on it. It's taken us time to find a way to fund it and manage the concerns. But, you know, it's just a part of a process that plays out several times in Raleigh. And it's an example of where when Representative Womble was in the majority, he was reaching out to people in the minority to work on a bipartisan basis. And we've continued that tradition in getting this bill done.
Representative Womble, you started this about 10 years ago, as I said. What took so long from your point of view, and why now?
Well, I guess everything is in its own time, and I guess it was just time for it. But you are correct. I started on this several years ago, 10, 11 years ago. I kept putting the bill in, and each time, each session, it would not make it to the floor, so the next session I'd put it in again. So I kept putting it in repeatedly until sometimes perseverance pays off. You stick to it and it'll pay off, and this session it did pay off. And I think, as I said before, the stars just lined up right, or it was just destiny for it to happen this particular time. And it was bipartisan, and I'm glad of that. I'm happy about that. I must give a great deal of credit to Ms. Elaine Riddick, Ms. Nell Ramirez, and Mr. Lynch, and several others, I can't call them all by name, for keeping this on the forefront, keeping it out there on the front burner. I must also give a great deal of credit while I'm giving it to Ms. Riddick, give it to the Speaker. He wasn't the Speaker at that time. He was just another legislator like I was. But I did approach him, and he was receptive, and he did see merit in the bill that I kept putting in, and he had promised me he'd give it due consideration.
Yeah, this is an example, Ms. Riddick, of a lot of activism on the part of a citizen. I know that you were personally affected by that, by this eugenics program, and we'll talk extensively about that a little bit later on. But you really were kind of pushing this issue, this reparations issue. What was that experience like for you? Because not many citizens get involved at that level.
Well, you know, for one thing, it was like something that kept pushing me and encouraging me, and I kept hearing the voice of God telling me that I have to do this. I have to do this because before I thought it was only me, and then as it kept going on, I realized that it was so many people that was affected by this heinous crime that was inflicted upon them.
Tom Tillis, this is an interesting year, not only because of the bipartisan nature of this agreement, and despite the fact that you say there are a lot of bipartisan things that go on, it's been a not only in Raleigh but also in Washington. It's no secret that there is a lot. There's very little love lost between the two political parties at the moment. But aside from that, we're also in this environment of cost cutting. And to put through a measure that allows or sets aside $10 million at a time when the legislature has been looking at every line item in the budget and cutting seems remarkable as well, is it?
It was work, and that was part of the discussion, because we're still in a sluggish recovery, and there's a lot of competing. You know, you had education interests saying, I can use this in education. You had health and human services interests saying that we need it more there, but I mean, we need to look back and take a look at the obligation that we have to the victims of this program and recognize that it should be a priority, and that it's a program that is available to those who are alive today. And quite honestly, many of them are Ms. Riddick's very young. She's only a year or two, a difference between her and my age, and her story is something that's affected me greatly. But, you know, the time is now, because there are many people who have passed away since we've been working on this, and we just felt like it needed to be a priority. And fortunately, we got the consensus of the Senate, the House members, and the governor that it was, in fact, a priority.
Speaker Tillis, this is Julie. I'm curious to know how you were able to convince Senate Republicans to support the compensation this year when the effort failed last year. I mean, what concessions did you have to make to them?
Well, you know, what we decided to do, and, you know, quite honestly, it's something I may have should have considered in the prior budget. We decided to make this a part of the negotiation process in the budget. We had a good number of members, including Senator Berger, who supported the plan. He's publicly stated that, but there were concerns. So ultimately, we decided to make this something that was a priority in the House to negotiate out the budget, and that was how we were successful with getting it done.
So did you have to forego another priority of your own in order to get this in the budget?
No, it's bigger than that. You know, the budget's almost $21 billion and 300 pages long. So there was no sort of this provision for that provision. It was really taken as a whole. And you know, in the budget, we felt very good in the House that most of the priority positions in the budget prevailed. There were a few areas that we would like to have seen moderation, but it wasn't any one thing, Julie. It's not really how the budget process works. Hmm.
As I said, North Carolina was not alone in having a eugenics program. Many states had them. I'm not sure how many did, but I know that Virginia had
more
one.
Than 30.
More 30. Than 30.
33 states.
And Virginia had one, and Virginia also tried earlier this year to put a compensation program in place. They failed, and we've become the first state to do so. Do you think that this compensation program will become a prototype or an example that other states will use to compensate victims in their state?
I think that it could, because what we've done over the years is we've taken the time to figure out how would you actually go about implementing this program. How would you be able to manage the fiscal obligation? How can you be absolutely certain that you're reaching out and identifying potential victims and certifying that they were, in fact, a part of the state-sponsored program. So we've got a lot of the mechanics. It was amazing how much time we had to spend when we finally thought that we were getting support for the bill to get the mechanics right on the administration. And I do think that other states that are looking at this could use this as legislation that could be a model for them.
And Mike, one thing that when you're talking about Virginia, first of all, the model they were working on was very similar to what has been attempted in previous years here in North Carolina. It was the idea of giving each of the living victims, or maybe any victim whose family, that was one of the questions, is it just living victims? Is it victims and their, or the descendants of deceased victims? Mm-hmm. Because many have passed away, as Speaker Tillis has said. So one of the things that North Carolina did to sort of limit that is to say only living victims. I think one of the things that has been was a problem, the pushback in Virginia, one of the reasons that bill failed was there's a concern that if we're going to say $50,000 to anyone who was sterilized under this program, it could be tens and hundreds of millions of dollars when it's unclear how many people are still alive. Mm. So finding a way to kind of limit how much exposure the state's budget was going to have was one of the things that really stalled the Virginia effort. And one thing that two things North Carolina did to manage that, those concerns were, first of all, to say only living victims. Second of all, to say, look, it's $10 million and we're going to split that among the living victims. We're not going to say $50,000 each. We're going to say, here's $10 million. Everybody who's a living victim, come forward, be verified in the records. We'll split the money evenly. And so that sort of puts a little bit of a cap that I suspect was was easier for some lawmakers to swallow when you're dealing with a budget and cuts and having to limited resources.
Elaine Riddick, you've been working on this for quite a while. What did you hope to achieve when you set out?
Well, my hope was to get North Carolina to recognize what they had did to the victim, to its citizens, and to understand that that was a horrific thing to do, that only God have the right to do these kind of things. People have human rights, and, you know, and because my rights were violated, one of my most human rights, you know, and I was so wanted to have children. And when I found out that they had been taken away from me, you know, it was like, oh, my goodness. I mean, I was totally devastated. And I felt like nobody should have that right to do that to any human being.
But were you looking for specific compensation, or were you looking for just simply an acknowledgement that the state was wrong? What were you looking for?
Well, actually, I've been fighting this since I was 19 years old. And of course, I'm 59 now, so I've been fighting this for over 40 years. Mm-hmm. And when I first set out towards this, my aim was to get, I first sued the state of North Carolina back in the 70s for $1 million. Unfortunately, that didn't fall through because of the the jury. It was a selective jury, and they decided that North Carolina had not violated my human rights.
Wow. This became a, I'm told, Mr. Speaker, this became a personal mission for you. Why?
Well, you know, I have a tendency to stake myself out, and when somebody asks me a question, I have this habit of answering it honestly, and somebody asked me what I felt about the our inability to get this done 2 years ago. I said I considered it a personal failure. It's something I set out to do. You know, to me, it's just sound policy. It also, in my opinion, happens to be sound conservative policy. What Elaine just said, we need to come back to. We had a government program in North Carolina where legislators who sat in the seats that we occupy now thought that it was an appropriate exercise of government power to take away your reproductive rights because they deem you unfit to have children for whatever reason. That, to me, throughout the history of North Carolina over the last 1.5 centuries, is probably the most egregious public policy I've seen go on the books. And I felt like, for that reason, we needed to stand up and address it and recognize mistakes. When mistakes are made, we're part of an institution that carries on that legacy, and by being silent on it, we're really condoning it at some level, and it was not something I wanted to condone personally.
Tom Tillis is the Republican Speaker of the House in Raleigh. We're going to continue our conversation about reparations for the eugenics program that was a long-running, 45-year-old-running program in North Carolina in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarkets, introducing Czech soda with a variety of flavors, including orange pineapple, grape, strawberry, and premium draft root beer. Available at Bilo. And more information at buy-lo.com. Well, it's been a crazy summer, meteorologically speaking. Raging fires going on in the west, where it's very dry and hot. Eastern half of the country drowning in rain. Our state has experienced record amounts of rainfall, and government agencies at all levels have had to mobilize like never before to handle flooding and road washouts and things like that. And while the rain's been beneficial to some, it's caused suffering for others. It's leaving all of us to wonder what is going on and when will this end. The story of our soggy summer tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, American Airlines and U.S. Airways say their merger will increase competition, but critics fear higher prices and reduced service, the effects of airline consolidation.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Tillis is with us. He's the Republican Speaker of the House. Larry Womble, a Democrat, former member of the House, just recently left because of health reasons. Elaine Riddick is a eugenics victim who will now be compensated thanks to a bipartisan agreement in the legislature this past session. She joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. And Julie Rose from WFAE News is with us. She's been reporting on this story for several years. Mr. Womble, I know that you started working on this 10 or 11 years ago. It was a hard slog. You kept putting the bill through. It kept getting rejected. Mr. Tillis just told us that the reason it got through this time in large part is because it was attached to budget negotiations, which, has, as Julie told me off the air, has to go through fewer committees, and so it had a better shot at this. But I was also surprised. I asked both of you before we began this conversation on the air, and I was surprised by the answer. This turned out not to be as controversial as most of us would think. There has not been a lot of blowback on this decision, has there?
No, it has not, at least from my point of view, because I think that it was time for it to be done. This program has been going on for quite a while in North Carolina. The interesting thing about it is when other states were winding down their program, North Carolina ratcheted up this program. But I'm glad it came to a point in time when they said, it's time for us to correct this wrong, this hideous wrong that was done against people, citizens, little children, boys and girls who had not done anything wrong. So it was time for it to be done. And we could not keep putting it off and making excuses and trying to derail it and trying to put it off to the side. And it came to a point in time, it's the right thing to do, as my grandmother used to say, it's the right thing to do simply because it is the right thing to do. And I'm so happy and glad, and I'm just elated that I live long enough to see this, that my bill that I'd been putting in several years ago finally come to a reality. I know that sometimes people kept telling me it's not going to happen. But when you get right people of the right mind who want to do things and who want to make sure that right is done, such as Speaker Tillis and such as Elaine Riddick kept urging me and encouraging me, to Representative Womble, you can't quit, you can't give up. Keep fighting, we're standing behind you, her and people like Ms. Ramirez and Mr. Lynch. And also a person by the name of Mr. John Raley, who first reported that to me. That's how I got involved and thought something should be done. So I'm glad that there is something to be said about stick-to-itness. There's something to say about perseverance. You hang in there. Sooner or later, what's done in the dark will come to the light.
I called this practice disgraceful. Mr. Womble has characterized it as heinous. And it strikes me as odd that 33 United States were involved in this practice for such a long period of time, and that it was so difficult in North Carolina, and it's proved to be difficult in other states to come to an agreement on what should be done for the people who were harmed by this practice. And it smacks exactly of what went on in Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s. Why has this been so difficult for states to come to a resolution on? How did we allow this practice? I know you looked into the history of this, Julie. How did we allow this practice to go on, particularly after World War II and what we witnessed in Germany, and particularly when other states began to decrease the practice, as Mr. Womble just said, North Carolina ratcheted it up.
Right. Well, I think there are two issues that you're talking about. One is how this was able to happen, how eugenics was able to how it was possible that we could allow this to happen. And the second piece is why it's been so difficult to to make it right. First of all, how it happened. The Nazis actually got the idea from the U.S. I mean, there were U.S. pamphlets about eugenics and the science, which has since been debunked, about being able to kind of breed intellectual excellence and so forth. There were pamphlets that went over to the Nazi to the Nazis that sort of helped inform what they were doing. It is true that most of these states, that it was pre-World War II that this practice was most active in other states that had the program. After World War II, there were a few states, including North Carolina, where things really kicked in to high gear, and more of the sterilizations actually happened in North Carolina after World War II.
Yeah.
Part of that is because there was a group, there was this national advertising campaign that kind of kicked off regarding the value of sterilization. There was a group called the Human Betterment League. There were some Winston-Salem elites, heirs to the Procter & Gamble fortune, to the Reynolds fortune, were involved in this, funding this effort that had all of these brochures, and they were sort of promoting the idea on two fronts. First of all, sterilization as a way to help women who wanted to limit their reproduction, because at the time, birth control was not very effective, and so sterilization as like an option for birth control. And then also, really, I think the thing that was most significant, what really affected it in North Carolina, was this idea of needing to limit our welfare role. I mean, we had a huge number of women with children who were on the welfare rolls, and increasingly those were African Americans, and there was a concern among the community, the Health and Human Services community in North Carolina, that we got to figure out some way to keep these people from having all of these kids, and then we're just paying for more and more of these families, these mothers and children and young girls having babies.
But I think it could also be argued that there was a racial component to this, a racist component to this. In that pamphlet you're talking about, it was published in 1950, the Human Betterment League of North Carolina said the board that made these decisions about who would be sterilized and who would not was protecting, quote, the children of future generations and the community at large, adding that you wouldn't expect a moron to run a train or a feeble-minded woman to teach school. And they defended the practice by saying it is not barnyard castration. Now, Elaine, you say they butchered you like a hog. You mean that literally or figuratively?
I really mean that. They butchered me like a hog. When I said they butchered me like a hog, let me explain what I meant, is that when they went inside of me and they sterilized me, you know, they had no concerned about what was, you know, my age. I was a victim of rape at the age of 13 years of age. I had my son at the age of 14. When I went into the hospital to give birth to my son, they actually went inside of me and cut me open, and they did away with some of my parts, you know. And then they didn't give me any aftercare. I did not receive aftercare. So what I'm saying is,
did they tell you what they were going to do? Did you know what was going to happen? Did they ask permission for what they were going to do?
Well, with me, I was too young. They didn't ask. I didn't give no permission. As a matter of fact, I didn't find out that they had did this to me until I was 19 years of age.
Did an adult?
They went to my grandmother. They went to my grandmother, who was illiterate, never got out of the first grade, and coerced her into signing an X for them to do this to me, for them to sterilize
me. They coerced
her,
I'm told, by threatening to cut off her food.
Food supplements. Yeah. They were at that time. They were receiving what you call it, surplus foods. You know, like canned cheese, powdered cheese, or powdered eggs in a can, or some kind of stuff, and some kind of meats. Anyway, it was surplus food that I don't know what it was made out of, really.
Right.
But they threatened to take that away from her. And by my grandmother having a large family, you know, most of my grandmother's children was living with my grandmother, plus her grandchildren were living with her, plus her own children. She needed that because back at that time, you know, blacks didn't really have these jobs out here like they have now. Basically, their work was field work.
So this, by my calculations, if you're 59 now and you were 14 then, this took place in what, 1968?
1968, yes.
That seems unbelievable. It's unfathomable to me that we would do something like that in 1968. And most people, I would think, are not really – most contemporary North Carolinians until this issue came up in the legislature probably didn't know much about this. Tom, tell us, when were you aware of this?
Representative Womble, my freshman term, had an information session. I went there to learn about it, and I was aghast. And, you know, I think you're right, Mike, that in the later end of the program, there's a fairly compelling body of evidence to say that African Americans disproportionately were subjected to forced sterilization. There were thousands of whites and other ethnicities subjected to it as well, but that's a part of the reason why I felt strongly that North Carolina, being really up with Virginia and California and the way they executed their programs, needed to step up and take a look at some form of restitution. But there's something else that still fascinates me, and I'd be curious if Representative Womble has anything to say, is why it took so long to get it done. Because if you think about the political makeup and the time that Representative Womble has worked on this, Democrat governor, Democrat speaker, Democrat president pro tem, triumvirate of leadership, and actually a few times where they didn't have the fiscal pressure, but there was something about this program that made people uncomfortable with taking it up. And it's not something I've seen studied much, but it fascinates me. I don't understand why.
Mr. Womble?
Well, there are several reasons why that they did not take it up, especially when we were in control. One was the excuse of that we can't afford it. Another excuse was we don't want to fully admit that we had done something like that here in North Carolina. Another reason was that it would set a precedent. We had never done anything like this. No other state had done anything like this. We have no roadmap to go by. We have no guidelines to go by. So we're plowing in fields that have never been plowed before. Those were just some of the reasons, or if you want to say excuses, given for not taking this up.
Does it strike you as odd, Mr. Womble, as a Democrat, that it took the Republican Party to make this happen?
Well, I'm glad that Speaker Tillis, when I went to Speaker Tillis, he was open and receptive to looking into this and doing what he could, and gave me his word that this was a horrendous thing to do. It's despicable. You should not do this to human beings. And it just played on his conscience and everybody else's conscience. The time is right. We cannot deny this anymore. We cannot put this off anymore. We must step up to the plate. The government did this. The government need to step up to the plate and take responsibility for this. And you're right. No, not a lot of people knew about this kind of thing that was going on. Government has awesome powers, and we must be vigilant to make sure the government does not abridge those rights that belongs to citizens.
I would think when this began around the country, and when it began in North Carolina in the late 20s, and even into the 30s and 40s, that there were a lot of very sincere people who believed the pseudoscience behind this, that they could actually accomplish the betterment of the human race by doing something like this. So their heart perhaps was in the right place. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. But by the 50s and 60s, certainly that could not have been the case. And I'm wondering, as an African-American, Mr. Womble, how you feel, how much racism do you think was involved in all of this?
Well, there has been comments made that it was genocide, that it was a way to wipe out a whole race of people. And if it wasn't a whole race of people, then a whole economic level of people, because they were considered to be a drain on society. They were considered to be using up the resources without contributing back. And this was one way to address that, wherein that if they were not here, we got rid of them, then we would not have to pay for them, and it would not be a responsibility to us as a society to look after them. And then that there was a science, supposed to be, but it was a pseudoscience, a junk science, that these people... And that goes to the point that I've been making and several other people have been making, that you cannot play God with human beings. You cannot determine who lives or who dies, especially when they haven't done anything. It's called genetic engineering. And some of the big companies in this country, not only in North Carolina, in this country, bought into that junk kind of scientist, that you can manipulate society like that And I'm hoping that this is a good example of what can go wrong, and you're not supposed to do things like this to people. And as Elaine and Ms. Ramirez have said to me repeatedly, you cannot do society. You cannot engineer. You cannot manipulate society according to your whims and according to what you want to do for this kind of pseudoscience like that.
But
my hat is off to North Carolina. And now that we have been the first and only one in this nation, we may be the first in the world to compensate people for this kind of thing. And I'm hoping that we'll be the beacon of light that can shine, that yes, if you hang in there and if you're sincere and you persevere for what is right, right is right, and right won't wrong nobody.
Julie.
And Mike, I just wanted to share a few points of data to back up what Representative Womble is saying there. First of all, that the sterilizations in North Carolina up until the 60s were racially balanced, and actually 70% overall of people who were sterilized were women. But that means 30% were men, often young boys. It was typically in the early days. It was people in mental hospitals. It was people in prisons. And the thinking was, we don't want to perpetuate whatever they've got that's making them do these things that we think are not socially acceptable. But you're right. By after World War II, the science of eugenics had been debunked. We knew what Nazi Germany had been doing. Most states dropped their programs. This is when, in North Carolina, it shifted to women on welfare, where the focus was primarily people who were poor and therefore unfit in some way to raise children, and we didn't want to have to pay for them. And I do want to point out one of the things. So from 1960 on, it becomes majority black, majority female. Who are the victims of North Carolina's eugenics board. And North Carolina was the only state that allowed social workers to make the recommendation. That was critical to those years post-World War II.
And this is what happened to you, Elaine. You came to the attention of the eugenics board through the intercession of the very people who should have been trying to protect you, social workers. As an individual who was affected by this, can you comprehend the thinking that went behind a social worker turning in a 14-year-old girl who had been raped?
Well, you know, I look at it like this, is that she was part of the eugenics. You know, she took it on her own to go in front of a board and ask for them and submitted a document. You know, nobody had really talked to me at that time. But, you know, at that time, social workers had a lot of rights, a lot of pull. You know, anything, and even a neighbor, anything anyone said, it might not have been true, you know, the eugenics board just believed them. You know, but, and then again, too, you have to look at my background, my mother and my dad, you know, and that gave them even more authority over me.
This sounds, and I'd like to hear, I only have a minute left in this segment, I'd like to hear from the three of you about, just give me a one-word description of how this strikes you, because it sounds to me sinister, cruel, even evil. Elaine, how does it strike you?
Cruel.
Mr. Tillis?
Cruel.
Mr. Womble?
I would say cruel and also sinister.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk more about Elaine's particular story here and how this came to her and the impact of forced sterilization on her life, and more about how reparations came to pass in the legislature and when they will go out and to whom they will go to when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Lenore Ryan University graduate programs offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. The Justice Department, along with several state attorneys general, dealt American Airlines and U.S. Airways an unexpected blow yesterday by seeking to block their proposed merger. The airlines say their union would increase competition, but critics fear that higher prices and reduced service may be the result and that the consumers would pay the price. Diane and her guests discuss the impact of airline consolidation on consumers and on local economies, coming up on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. You can join that conversation. You can join ours right now about eugenics and compensation for that program over the years at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
It's an art exhibit to be sure, but instead of paintings and sculptures, it's subprime mortgages.
It says Rehm Home Resource Center. We are here to share our housing information and experiences with you. All questions and comments are welcome.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Home ownership and the Great Recession go on display next time on Marketplace. It's from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the decision by the on the part of the legislature, a bipartisan decision to provide reparations for those who were impacted by the North Carolina Eugenics Program, which was in full force in 1929 through 1974. Tom Tillis is the Republican Speaker of the House from Mecklenburg County. Larry Womble is a former Democratic member of the House. Both join us by phone. Julie Rose is in our studio from WFAE News, and Elaine Riddick is a victim of the eugenics program who joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. I asked each of the three people on the phone and in remote studios, Julie, a moment ago, how they would describe this eugenics program, evil, sinister, or just simply cruel.
Mm-hmm.
And several said cruel, and one of them said evil. Let's talk about the sinister nature of this, because this it still goes on today.
Right. And I would also maybe throw in the word complicated. And this is in no way to justify what happened. The eugenics board and a program allowing people to be sterilized against their will without consent or through coercion. No one has said that that is acceptable or that ever should have taken place. And we've apologized for it as a state and now are compensating. But I do want to point out that in the 7,600 or so people who were ordered sterilized by the North Carolina Eugenics Board, there were cases. One researcher found several hundred cases of women who quite clearly requested this. And I think this was a time before 1960, before the pill was fully available, when birth control measures were not very effective. There were women who wanted sterilization as a way to stop from having more children. It was seen as another birth control method. In fact, Wallace Kuralt, who was very well known in Mecklenburg County, he was the health director. He promoted it. And the other thing I will mention, too, is that there were also cases in which people who were mentally ill, severely mentally ill, you know, their families wanted it. And this was through full consent, at least to the families and the caregivers of these individuals. What I will say, though, is that in hindsight, I think most people I've spoken to, including the social workers who were involved in this process, feel as though there was a sense that the machinery was moving, that once you set in place a system where, with very little evidence, an individual could be deemed feeble-minded and therefore ordered sterilized, and a doctor could then be, you know, feel free to do the sterilization, because in a lot of cases, people would not do elective sterilization. Doctors just wouldn't touch it because they felt like there was too much liability. But if the eugenics board gave them clearance to do it, then they would gladly go ahead and do it in many cases. And so this was a situation where the structure was put in place to where it was a net that caught up so many more people than it ever should have or could have otherwise, and led to the situations like we have with Elaine that are truly tragic.
We had a caller a moment ago who couldn't hold, who identified himself as a white male whose sister had been sterilized, and he said that it was a damn fine thing that she was, and feels that our conversation is one-sided.
Well, and I think also that it was because she said she was mentally ill, I think was the clarification there.
Well, and I think that is a very important point as a part of the authentication, the process that we're going through to identify victims. I would hope that anyone who knowingly and voluntarily asked that someone be sterilized, either because they're they're responsible for this person's care if they're mentally ill or there's some physical debilitation. I would hope that they would not seek compensation in the interest of people like Elaine who had this forced on them. That's what we're talking about here. And the caller, I wish that I'd had an opportunity to speak with the caller. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a forced taking for centuries when a citizen is harmed by the government. We go through a court process, and they get restitution when they've proven that they have been harmed. That's what this is about, and nothing more, nothing less.
How will you determine who gets compensation?
Anyone who is able to authenticate through the records that we've collected and through the administrative process that we put together that can demonstrate that they were sterilized through the state-sponsored program. You should keep in mind there were other eugenics programs going on within the state that were not a result of the state program. Mm-hmm. To the extent that they're able to authenticate that they were a victim, then they become qualified. And as a part of that process, as Julie said, it's fairly well documented. Those who came in and, as a matter of record, said, I want to have this procedure done to myself or I want to have this procedure done to my child for these reasons. And again, that will be a part of the process of authentication. And I find it hard to believe. In fact, I would find it disrespectful that for someone who requested this procedure to then come back and seek restitution at the expense of people like Elaine, who clearly deserve it.
Representative Womble, you referred to the awesome power of the government to do things to individual citizens that needs to obviously have checks and balances to it. What legal standing did this state or any other state who engaged in this program have? And if there was a law that allowed it, when was the law in North Carolina repealed?
Well, I put in a bill. That's it's two parts to my bills. The first bill I put in was to repeal it off the books because it was technically still on the books. We could still legally do it. So I had to get rid of the bill, get rid of the law.
And Larry, that was only about 10 years ago, right? 10 or 12 years ago?
Yeah. Exactly. So that was the first thing I had to do.
So if the law was still on the books, why wasn't it still being done?
The Eugenics Board was disbanded in 1974, I think. So okay. It was no longer functioning. We have a lot of laws on our books that are not enforced.
Okay.
This was one of those, but it was clearly one that, you know, Representative Womble, that we needed to remove.
Yeah. But, Julie, it's interesting, though, again, going back to what was going through the minds of those legislators, mm-hmm. because the proposals to repeal that language had been out there before, and it's remarkable to me that for some reason they didn't even want to deal with something that wasn't functioning that would have, you know, put a tighter cap on the program that ended effectively in 1974.
Well, that was one of the things we had to do, convince them, even though the board had been disbanded. It was a 5-member board with the attorney general having a seat on that board. It's to, first of all, get rid of it. They say, well, we're not using the law anyway. Even though you're not using it, by it still being on the books, the potential was still there to resurrect it and use it. So I had to get rid of it, just the legal end of it. Legally, we had to get rid of it. So that's what my first bill did, take it off the books. And that's what I had to do in order to do that. Now, why did they have the mindset to do it? I guess many of them did not want to do it, or as I said before, did not want to wake up sleeping dogs, let sleeping dogs lie. Mm-hmm. It's too controversial. We don't want to bother with that now. Is open up a can of worms.
And you two, both of you, Mr. Tillis, Mr. Womble, have talked to me about how much of an education this process really has been. I think back to even just a couple of years ago when there was suddenly, when all of these task forces, I think it was the third task force that had been organized to discuss and figure out what to do about compensation. And then really it seemed to me what turned the tide in a lot of this was when there was that listening session a couple of years ago when folks like Elaine Riddick, victims came and told very emotionally in front of national cameras what they had been through. And suddenly it seemed to me, at least, like that was when sort of people realized, look, we've awoken this. We have to address it. We got to figure out a way to deal with it.
Part of it was awareness. You have to make people aware of these kinds of atrocities. And the way I had to do it was to have hearings before the various committees that were down there. I had to pay for these people to come and testify. And many of them did not want to. They were afraid. They didn't want the stigma. But to get the hearing done, get it made aware. So that's the first thing. Then after you were aware of the people of it, you had to educate them about the horrendous implications for this. And then after you educate them, many people's eyes were open that, yes, this is bad. It's right up there with the Tuskegee experiment that they did down in Florida with those people with the syphilis. We have to make people aware of these kinds of things.
Was there
many things are hidden away? Many things are hidden away. This is just one thing that was seen the light of day. And once the light of day was shined upon it, then people began to react.
Once an individual was targeted by the eugenics board, once the decision had been made by the board that they were going to be sterilized, male or female, was there an appeals process? Could you get out of it? Could you say no? Was there a way out?
There was an appeals process. It was not effective. And some 90% of people who were referred to the eugenics board were ultimately sterilized. And there are very clear and actually very kind of heartrending cases that, that have been made public, but not the names, but just the stories, the case studies that show these families traveling to Raleigh to appeal, you know, saying, look, this is not right. We don't agree with this. You can't do this. And yet the eugenics board would uphold its decision.
Elaine Riddick, describe the impact this has had on your life.
Wow. You know, once I started talking about it, and as Wumber taught me about the putting a name to the face. Once people started seeing my face and knowing my name, it was, I don't know, it was just unbelievable. I mean, it was sometimes, at times it could have been embarrassed. At times I was humiliated. And at times, you know, people would just point their fingers. But it was just, that didn't matter. What mattered to me was making sure that the world understood the complications of forced sterilization.
But talk to me about the impact that forced sterilization has had on your life. As I understand it, although you were raped and raped at 13, sterilized at 14, you were married at 18. And when your husband found out that you couldn't have children, he divorced you.
Yeah, that was horrible. When he found out that this had happened to me, he would call me a waste or barren. He said to me at one point, that I should have died on the table when they were doing that to me, or he made me feel like I had did something wrong. But you have to remember, I didn't know when I got married to this guy, I didn't know that that had happened to me. I didn't find out until after we were married. And we was married a year, and the following year we was out to start a family. And to find out that this had happened to you, oh my God, it's just mind-blowing.
And I think also mind-blowing, Mike, is just the general lack of understanding and misinformation that was going on during this process, too. So, Elaine, I mean, you kind of think, well, how could you not know that you had been sterilized? But, you know, Elaine was had just given birth to a child at 13, 14 years old, you know, and the doctors say we got to go in and fix something. In some cases, they were told it was an appendectomy that they were getting. In some cases, people were told that it was reversible. We're just going to do this now, but when you're ready to have kids down the line, we can reverse this, which was largely untrue.
With me, you know, the way they went in and did me, it's like, you know, when they went in and when it was time for me to give birth, they took my son, they cut me open, took my son, and while they was in there, that's when they did all this at the same time, so you would have never known.
Yeah. Right. You had a C-section, right, Elaine? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I found out later, you know, many years later, that's what it was.
The state has set aside $10 million to compensate victims. How was that figure arrived at, Mr. Tillis?
The original thought process was based on the number of victims that we had identified, which is approaching 200. It's a little bit less than that. Some have passed away over the past couple of years, but there had been proposals in the past of 25,000 and 50,000. So at the time, we just used that as a way to get to a number. It was admittedly arbitrary. But I think back to a point that made me think about it with Julie's comment in the budget. Julie, I think the way that it ultimately became viable in the budget was when we decided to cap it at $10 million so that we had the fiscal risk addressed for some of the people that were opposing it on that basis, not against the program, just how much were they going to have to spend on it? But that's how we arrived at it, Mike.
Because, Mike, there are, you know, an estimated, at one point there was an estimate that maybe 2,100 of the 7,600 were still alive. Then they kind of revised that, the state statistician, down to 1,500. But truthfully, in the last couple of years, with all the noise about this, only 177 as of July have come forward. So
that's right.
It could be much, much smaller.
Elaine, you're in your late 50s. You've worked your entire adult life on getting reparations. You've called what they've earmarked for you as shut up and go away money. Would any amount have been adequate?
No. No.
And in an article in the LA Times in January of 2012, you said that you would refuse what was then rumored to be the level of $50,000, which has turned out to be true. Do you plan to refuse the money?
Well, I see the money, the $50,000, still as an insult. But, you know, there's a lot of let me tell you, I changed my mind because I decided that I wanted to develop a youth program, and I can use that money to reconstruct our youth. Or if not for that purpose right there, I would also like to, it's two things that I want to do with the rest of my life. And the other one is that I would like to develop a sister sanctuary. A sister sanctuary is a place where young girls can come, where they can get nourishment if they find themselves pregnant. They would come here and they would be taught about childbearing, parenting, and all of these things here. So, yes, at this point, I would have to accept the money, and hopefully the state of North Carolina would add a little bit more to assist me with my dream.
I only have about 40 seconds left, but have you heard from other victims, and what has been their reaction to the decision to pay $50,000 per person?
Are you speaking to me?
I think the representatives.
Okay.
I think we've heard a number of things. I do think that Elaine's point is an argument that was used by people against it. Why are we moving with this? Because it's not going to be enough, and we'll get criticized for that. That's why we had to make the decision to move forward. But generally, we've had very good response.
That's right. I would say, and there's an old saying, a half a loaf is better than no loaf.
That's Larry Womble, Democrat and former member of the House in North Carolina. Tom Tillis is the Republican Speaker of the House. Together, they arrived at a decision to pay reparations during this last legislative session, which will begin to be going out in 2015. I'm not sure why the lag time there, but we haven't got time to ask that question now. Elaine Riddick is a eugenics victim, and Julie Rose is a reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.